Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Tara Linney. She is an international award-winning educator who's helped several schools nationally and internationally with launching and sustaining effective one-to-one programs over the course of the last decade. She holds a BA in Mass Communications from the University of South Florida and an MS in the Science of Instruction from Drexel University. She also holds a certification as an Instructional Technology Specialist. Her understanding of how technology fits in education is vast. In both planning and training, Tara can speak both IT and education technology. In 2018, Tara authored and published the book, Code Equity, Keying Girls into Coding, as a guide for educators looking to make a more equitable learning environment for their students, particularly in the teaching of computer science topics. Her overall mission is to create a culture of equitable learning conditions for learners of all ages. Welcome to the podcast, Tara.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Oh, goodness. There's been so many. Let's see. I think one of the hardest kind of like life-shifting times that I was in the trenches was my first year teaching. So I am a career changer. For the first 7 years of my professional career, I worked in nonprofit and marketing arenas. And then I decided, you know, nonprofit is great, but what I really want to do is like see the impact that I'm having on people and helping them. And so I got into education. That very first year, I was working in Philadelphia, public schools, and I received a pink slip. And I had never received a pink slip in my entire life. So it was my first full year of teaching. And it was, you know, like most first years are, going home crying every day of the month, it feels like, and but learning a lot and then working on my graduate degree and my teacher certification at the same time. And so after that first year, we only had maybe about a week left of school. My principal calls me to the office and I was like, yeah, are you planning for next year? And she was like, I have a letter for you. She had me open the letter in front of her and everything. And I was like, what just happened? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So the year was 2010. And that was actually the year that there were a lot of budget cuts and they had laid off 2,000 to 3,000 teachers in the city of Philadelphia, as well as teachers like across the country. And so I thought at that point, like, holy cow, like maybe education is not for me. You know, you're thinking this new teacher, first year, you get a pink slip after your first year. You think that it's you. You don't realize that there's all these other forces at play. And so when I got the pink slip, I was like, well, I'm still scheduled to teach summer school. So I taught summer school. And then I was like, oh no, is this the end? Mm-hmm. So then I got back into my previous work in marketing. I did that for most of the summer. And then I was like, no, I should try this education thing again. And so just kind of, I think what helped me in that case was the fact that I was still in grad school when I got the pink slip. So I was still learning, I was still growing, and that enabled me to see like, okay, this is normal. People mm-hmm. get laid off. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't mean that I'm a horrible person. There's hope somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, kind of that shock, right? That I think that had a lot of shock value for you. Just as you said, a week before the end of the school year and just kind of brusquely getting that and not knowing, you know, just thinking, oh, this is to talk about your schedule for next year, right? But then as you pointed out, there were a lot of budget cuts at the time. And, you know, there's a lot of times, you know, that's kind of when you are that new teacher, new to the building, that it just, there's just a lot of factors into play, right? That, you know, first one in, first one out, or last one in, first one out, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, you know, the fact that you were working on that graduate degree, you know, you didn't want to leave education. Where did you go from there then the next year and leading into kind of writing your book and getting more into educational technology?
So after that huge bump in the road, it was probably around July of that summer. I was like, I was doing marketing work and I was like, I feel not as fulfilled as I felt in education for the 1 year that I was there. Mm-hmm. And so I just started throwing my resume out to like every place that had an opening with one little caveat. So my master's degree is in education and I have a certification as an instructional technology specialist. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on these tech related things at the same time as working on my teacher certification and my master's degree. Mm-hmm. And in learning about technology and education and how it all works together, I started to apply for any type of technology based job. Mm-hmm. Like if it was technology teacher, if it was technology coach, like what have you. Mm-hmm. So I landed in Charlotte, North Carolina as a technology teacher at an elementary school. Yeah.
Wow. And did that take, you said you were in Philly, so you ended up moving all the way to North Carolina for your job, right? And so yes. Was that quite a different type of position after that first year getting into being a tech teacher? And then did that take a learning curve?
So there wasn't so much a learning curve. And in terms of like geographically speaking, mm-hmm. So when I took the job in Philadelphia, I had never been to Philly before. Mm-hmm. I'm not really from anywhere. So people like to say like, where are you from?
Yeah.
And I was like, no. And so that being said, so what'll happen is whenever people ask that question, I can't give an answer. I'm like, well, where was my favorite place or where was this or where was that? And so at the time I was living in Georgia when I got the job up in Philadelphia. And so when I moved up there, I had gotten, I had met some of my distant family from my dad's side for like the very first time in moving up to Philly, which was like really great. When I got the job in Charlotte, I had visited Charlotte before, but never actually lived there. So geographically it was like, oh, all right, familiarity. Mm-hmm. In terms of the job, the technology teaching was definitely an eye opener, mm-hmm. but what was challenging was that at the same time I was going through my master's program and my master's program kept saying, no, technology shouldn't be its own silo. It should be integrated. Mm-hmm. So I'm learning something that goes against what I'm doing mm-hmm. in that particular role.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that lead you into, you know, being more comfortable in the role of working with technology and edutech? And I mean, a lot has changed now. I mean, this was the 2010-2011 school year, correct?
Yep.
Started that job. So it's now been 10 years. And how have you seen shifts happen so much into the fact that you started gathering research for your book about girls in coding?
So I tend to be a very like analytical thinker. Like I'm working on doing this, putting together this SDGs and education playground. And I was just telling someone, I was like, if it's data, I'll do it. Like if it's a matrix, then I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to technology and the new advances and keeping up, there's a few different ways. So when I first got into teaching, one of the things that one of my grad school instructors had told the class was that we needed to become ISTE members. Mm-hmm. And so I've been an ISTE member now for 10 years, and just being connected in that organization where there's hundreds of thousands, okay, maybe 100,000 educators who are sharing in the commons and who are connecting at conferences and things like that. It helps me to keep abreast of like, whoa, what's this new thing? Mm-hmm. And I'm not afraid to like try new tools and break them, you know, in my mind at least, until I can figure out how to work them correctly. And I think that's one of the things in staying up to date with what's going on in the world of technology. It's being open to changes that happen literally like every second of every day, it feels like. Like even if you look at Google products, so like Google just changed from just totally changed the look of their icons and now calls it, instead of Google Suite or G Suite, it's now Google Workspace or Workshop, right? And so it's little things like that, staying connected in these ed tech communities and finding out what the updates are, and trying them out. Because you're not going to know how something works unless you've failed at doing it once. And then you won't fail again. Well, you might fail one more time after, but like the third time, definitely it works itself out.
And you talked about being a member of ISTE, and I've spoken, you know, with Sarah Thomas and some other people that we're both connected to on Twitter who are very active in ISTE as well. And, you know, I think going to those conferences, right, really gives you kind of an eye up on what are the latest tools and what you can be using. And I know, I think, is it in the spring they have their conferences usually?
The summer. Okay. I'm like, wait a minute, when are their conferences?
Yeah. So
2020.
Are you usually speaking or doing breakout sessions at the conference? And do you usually attend those yearly? So kind of what's been your experience in gathering maybe some of the latest tools from conferences?
So in the last 10 years, I did not attend ISTE in 2010 when it was in, I think it was in Philly in 2011. I didn't attend then because that was like my big shift of like, oh, wow, I just got laid off. And so, but I've attended every year since then. So I guess we're looking at 8 or 9 years consistently. So it's not just like going to this big event and seeing all these people and hearing from them, but it's like building actual connections and relationships with people based on some type of common thread. So there have been things in my professional life, like for example, back in 2011, I think I started going out for the Google Teacher Academy and I applied, I want to say 6 times altogether before I was finally accepted. And part of like those smaller groups is being connected and having critical friends that are in those communities that can give you critical feedback on how to improve. And so once I kind of learned that like algorithm of, okay, this is what it's like to be a professional in education. Like this is, you know, here's the person that I need to reach out to if I'm looking for things on this product or that one or that one. I've now in my different groups, I've been the person that people come to when they want to be connected to someone. So kind of like a black book in my brain of like people and like what their strengths are and what their specialties are. And so, yeah.
Yeah. And I find that so interesting, like how, you know, you have your niche, right? And there's other people in the community who have their niche. And, you know, I think you're talking a little bit about that Google Teacher Academy. And is that the same thing as the certification? Because I did that, I think, in 16, that level one, level two, and then you have the innovator certification. Is that the same thing you're talking about?
So the Teacher Academy is like the grandfathered, like old version of the Google Innovator Academy.
Okay. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about kind of the work that you've been doing in 2020, focusing on teacher self-care and, you know, how, you know, in the remote learning environment or hybrid learning environment, there's been a lot of discussion recently on whether or not students should have their cameras on. You know, to, you know, see whether they're participating. You know, there are a lot of different views on that topic. And what would you advise teachers, especially I think at the secondary level, we're seeing that a lot of students who rarely answer, you know, and unmute and who don't have their cameras on.
So I think that right now with all of the remote learning going on and with like just the sheer amount of technology being used, having face-to-face is great when everybody has their cameras on, you can read facial expressions, you know, when they're not on mute, you can hear tone and voice. I think that with this generation of students and in light of everything that's going on in the world, there are different alternatives that we can do. Like, for example, if you're on a video conferencing call, empower students to use emojis and respond in a chat. If they don't feel comfortable using their voice, like maybe, I don't know, maybe their voice is changing. Maybe there's a lot of background sound. Who knows what's going on where they are logging in from. And so by using the chat, their voice is still included, but it's just the typed voice instead of the spoken voice. With the cameras on, the cameras on is tricky because like, you know, as educators, we want to be able to see what's going on. But as you hear about things that happen in different places, like there was a story about what happened in Florida in a student's home with the camera on with elementary students, you know, and sometimes we need to, we need to remember that sometimes students don't live in environments where they want to show everything that's behind them. One of the nice things that we've been seeing this year, especially, is that a lot of these video conferencing tools have started to integrate blur features where you can blur your background or you can change your background without having a physical green screen. And so if it is a background thing, then empower the students to use a different background. And if you're working with students that are like lead by example students, so whatever the teacher does, then they'll do, then maybe as the teacher, change your background and use a virtual background instead of like your physical space. Then that'll get the students to say, oh, I didn't know that that tool existed within this tool or that that feature existed within this tool. And it empowers them to be able to show their face without showing the setting.
Yeah, and I think that that's good for elementary kids who, you know, especially if they have those, you know, home environments that might not be the greatest to show, but they don't maybe know how to change your backgrounds. And, you know, I'm thinking about those middle schoolers that I interact with a lot, and they're always like, you know, they're on a call for a half an hour and they use 10 different backgrounds, right? And they sometimes, you know, distract because they're putting like, you know, these little icony flashy things in front of their face. So they... Once the kids get to a certain age, they're doing all kinds of silly things with, you know, the tech on to show, but it's like, it's good when they're showing their face. Right. And they can, you know, kind of play around with that. But yeah, we you know, I think kids are becoming more and more used to, you know, what the features are. And I'm glad that, you know, these tools, they've recognized kind of what needs to be done when there are a lot of kids using the tool and, you know, that we are, you know, able to see their faces, but not necessarily their backgrounds. And something else that a lot of districts are thinking about as we, you know, start second semester soon, and, you know, they have grades, at least in secondary school, you know, getting those assignments in the virtual learning environment. And I know a lot of teachers are using some form of Google Classroom. But, you know, there are a lot of teachers who are dealing with frustrations and, you know, students at the secondary level who just aren't turning in work or engaging, whether it be in those meetings or just engaging with the lesson through the Google Classroom assignment. So what would you advise teachers or schools who have lack of student engagement in that arena and just the turning in of assignments so they can actually be graded?
That is a great question. I think one of the first things starts with the engagement piece. And so if there are live lesson sessions going on, having some type of poll or inquiry that lives on Google Classroom, and you can just create a question on there and having like a Likert scale attached to it. Then all students have to do is choose one of the answers. So like, how was today's math lesson? And like scale of 1 to 5, right? And then in the comments, put any like questions that you have about things that we did or didn't do. Mm-hmm. So you do the poll first. The poll is an engagement piece that kind of takes a pulse of the class to see where everybody is. And that follows the live session that happens, or if it's a pre-recorded session, that follows that activity. Mm-hmm. Then giving the assignment. Because sometimes what's happening is that students will get an assignment, but maybe they didn't attend that that live session, or maybe they were checked out, or maybe there were things that they didn't understand, but because the class is only 30 minutes long, they didn't have enough time to get their questions answered. Okay. So there's a number of things that could be going on. Creating an online forum like discussion chat before assigning something allows those different uncertainties to be weeded out first. Then when assigning something, not making it due the same day or even the next day, mm-hmm. you give it a deadline of like 3 or 4 days. If by the fourth day, you still have 3 students who haven't turned it in, mm-hmm. then that's when you start to reach out to those students and look back at that Likert scale data and see like what similarities maybe exist. Mm-hmm. But then do personal touches of, is everything okay? And come at it from like a place of empathy and care, knowing that everybody is living a very different life now than one that they've ever lived before. So with that different life, expectations should also change and be just a bit more graceful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely think, you know, having that a little bit of time to reflect on, you know, what those students' reactions are after the teaching, right? And then assigning something, because I think a lot of teachers are just, you know, boom, 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 put out the assignments mm-hmm. and then you're done with that. You're done with that lesson plan, right? And I think those are great, great tools for teachers listening to kind of have that reflection time in the Likert scale, and then, you know, have those a few days to get the assignment in, because then I think kids have more time to then reflect on what the assignment was about. And especially when you do have class periods that aren't very long, right? And a lot of that time that you're spending during the class period is the SEL time. And, the shorter the class period, the less time you actually get to it, maybe explain an assignment. And that leads us a little bit into just incorporating SEL into the school day. So let's say an elementary school is, remote only, and they're teaching, they have several meetings throughout the day, but let's say it's maybe a total of 4 hours for maybe upper elementary school. How much time during those 4 hours of direct meeting time should they be taking to maybe have SEL activities? And what are some activities that teachers or those mental health providers can be doing with the students?
So the time question, that's a great question. When it comes to SEL, SEL, kind of like tech, is not something that has to stand by itself. Mm-hmm. The reason why I say that is because, so technology, it makes sense that at some point it stood by itself because it's this new thing. We didn't have smartphones 20 years ago. Well, 20, 30, I forget. I didn't have one in high school. You know, it was like the Zach Morris phone, all that. And so like that physical aspect, that technology aspect is something that has evolved a lot in the last century.
Yeah.
Social emotional learning, though, is basically being human. Mm-hmm. Right. And we've been humans for a longer time than there's been this like new at your fingertips technology. That being said, I think that when it comes to education and when it comes to figuring out how much time to give to SEL, we need to kind of take a step back and remember that there's a humanity layer in education. Mm-hmm. So it's not, oh, I need to carve out 20 minutes for SEL. Think of it like when you're having a meeting with adults. Think of it like when you call a family member. Mm-hmm. Hey, how's it going? You don't just jump down their throat with, oh my goodness, I have this burning question. You always mm-hmm. start with a greeting. Mm-hmm. And so even if it's infusing a new way of greeting students into that greeting and having every single student say, yeah, my weekend was X, my weekend was Y. That's one way in which you can incorporate SEL in. Also, when you're working with especially upper elementary students, subjects can be really overwhelming because it's the first time that they've seen the subject. It's a little less so when you get up in the grades, because like math concepts tend to repeat themselves and then just grow on that base content understanding. That being said, when you're working with upper elementary and you're incorporating something new, that time that during a physical class, you would have transition time and say, okay, we're going to take a break before we transition to the subject.
Yeah.
Incorporate some type of breathing exercise or some type of music exercise as the transition between those subjects. That brings the calm back into the classroom, and it lets the students better become self-managers of their own emotions and their own time because they see this transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's such a great idea because, as you're saying, you know, in high school, if they're doing remote only, you know, they transition from one Google Meet to another.
Classes,
but, you know, for the elementary school kids, right, who have that same teacher, yeah, having that a brain break, whatever type of brain break that may be, like you said, to kind of, you know, transition to get their mind in that other place from language arts to math or something like that. And that's definitely a good way to kind of incorporate SEL, I think, into the practice as well. Cause you are, you know, if you're transitioning into a story that you're going to discuss, you know, you're having those leading questions, like, you know, have you had this experience before? Or you mm-hmm. know somebody, you know, tying into that main character in the story, right? So let's talk a little bit about the equity gap and girls in tech and coding and what kind of, you know, research that you did for your book that you released a few years ago and how you've seen girls get more and more involved in tech just in the past 10 years since you've been working in ed tech and what you would see for the future for girls that are maybe going to graduate in the next 10 years.
Definitely. So when it comes to girls in tech, this is work that I started right after I was in Charlotte. I took a position and became the first ed tech coordinator at an all-girls school in Washington, D.C. And so when I was there, I was working with all girls, like all girls all the time, no boys. And so I really got to understand just how girls think and how they react in terms of if something isn't perfect, if something goes wrong, when learning new skills, when working together, different things like that. And so I had started a blogging club and the girls got kind of bored of writing and I wanted to try something new. So I'm like, all right, let's have a girls coding club. Mm-hmm. And so in that coding club, I had about 10 girls in that club after school, all elementary. And what I was noticing was that some of the girls who are especially high academically during the school day, when they were introduced to this new subject, computer science, right? And they didn't know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. It was like panic mode. It was like, I'm used to being perfect. Now what? And so when I saw that in one of my students, I started to do some more just outside research on why that is, why that exists. I interviewed some of my students and just did a mini case study with that group of girls. From there, a bunch of things happened. Let's see, to kind of sum it up, I was there for a couple of years. And then one summer, the summer that I became a Google certified teacher, I started to do some work for Tinker around running their summer enrichment camps and building out their curriculum. And especially in the summer enrichment camps, it was primarily boys. And I was like, I haven't seen boys in years. I've been working at all girls school. Like, why do you guys behave this way? No, that was honestly my first thought. And so, but having that like big kind of culture shock made me just made my brain just kind of wake up and be like, whoa, there are definitely major differences, right? Because I had been in this all-girls school. Now I'm working with boys and girls. My next school was boys and girls. And just in interacting with some of the teachers who wanted their students to try like Hour of Code activities, mm-hmm. I noticed how one girl behaved and how one boy behaved, mm-hmm. and just how they approached problem solving. So that was the first inkling of like, you know, I think teachers need to know about this and the different gender dynamics that go into learning something like computer science. Mm-hmm. And what really kind of nailed the hammer in the coffin was when I moved to Singapore, I set up an after-school coding club. Part of the problem was I called it Programming Pioneers, which is not an attractive name for all genders, yeah. You know, pioneers.
Yeah.
I had 24 boys and one girl sign up.
Wow.
So I turned that into a little case study and I was like, all right, social experiment. Let's see what's going to happen. And then I wrote a book shortly thereafter because I'm like, this can't be what always happens. And so basically, when it comes to gender equity and computer science, a lot of it is when we're integrating coding and computer science into our different learning environments, we need to take an inward look at how we're doing that. Mm-hmm. Are we saying everybody's going to build a game? Everybody's going to do this one thing? Who can destroy X, Y, and Z? Because if we're approaching it from that primarily male-based gender view, mm-hmm. then we're not looking at the whole child. If we go and we look at the whole child instead, we bring purpose into why we do things and purpose that they can see across different fields. So instead of making a game, why not incorporate some math into it and have students use Scratch or something to explain a math concept? Mm-hmm. Why not incorporate some digital citizenship into it and have students do digital storytelling using computer programming? So yeah, a lot of it when it comes to getting girls into coding and computer science is getting them hooked based on the purpose aspect instead of the game aspect.
Okay.
Because when they see that they can make something that makes a difference in somebody else's life, mm-hmm. then they're more likely to stay committed to learning more about computer science and the different fields that relate.
Yeah. And I see that with my own daughter who's in fifth grade. She literally likes Scratch and, you know, and both my son as well, who's in seventh, but, you know, just having that end goal, right. And then mm-hmm. having a communication tool where they're showing kind of what they've built with, and, you know, anything with Minecraft, anything with those types of games where they actually have something to show for their coding. Right. I think that lures a lot of kids in and, you know, they stay on those things. And, you know, she was explaining that to her aunt yesterday, kind of what she does on her game on the iPad. And like, so, you know, she was really, really engaged. And I, you know, sometimes they tell other people in their family and not their own parents. And they're like, that was the first
right.
hearing about, you know, what each thing does on the iPad that she's playing with there. So, and then, we talked a little bit in the pre-chat also as well about, you know, the infrastructure, just lack of devices. I think a lot of districts have used, you know, the last 8 months to make sure that they have funding for devices to the families. But we still are looking at a lack of infrastructure across the U.S., especially mm-hmm. in areas. And, you know, it's hard to believe in 2020 that there are communities that don't have internet access, right? And that people, you're still hearing this fall about people that are having to drive to Wi-Fi hotspots. So how would you see that evolving in the next 10 years? Because you would have thought, you know, back 10 years ago that a lot of places would have had this. So is that, because we talked in the spring a lot about just hearing that is like a utility. Everybody should have mm-hmm. internet, right? But well, why is it the case that there are so many rural areas and just areas, even pockets in suburbs that don't have enough infrastructure?
Well, I think one of the greatest things about everything that's happened in 2020, especially in terms of the pandemic and a lot of gaping holes that have been revealed, yeah. is that we're starting to see the inequities that exist in communities. Mm-hmm. And not even just saying, you know, looking at rural communities compared to urban, but what are the pockets within those urban communities where there aren't enough resources? What are the pockets within the rural communities where there are not adequate resources? Mm-hmm. And some of the great things that I've seen throughout the pandemic is that companies in small towns, in big cities, like across the US and even across the world to an extent, have started to step up because they see the need for education, and they have started to either purchase devices or purchase hotspots for districts and schools to give out to the students. I've also seen innovations of Wi-Fi equipped buses going out to different communities and being like a little stationary hotspot that also has bagged lunches on it. You know, so kids come up, they show their ID, they get access to the Wi-Fi if they're within a certain range, and they get their lunch. So I think it's a matter of looking creatively at A, what are the holes, mm-hmm. and B, what resources does a community have that can help fill those holes? Mm-hmm. And it takes time and it takes looking deeply and sometimes even bringing in outside people to say, oh, have you seen this? Because oftentimes when we're in the middle of this mud pit, we can't see outside of it. But when we've got somebody who's not in the middle with us, mm-hmm. Then they can actually see and say, hey, have you tried this? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's like looking to see what other communities are doing, not even like next door, but maybe a few states away. Mm-hmm. Like I know there's been a lot, particularly in the Gastonia region of North Carolina, for example, that their community might match one in Colorado. Mm-hmm. But the innovations that have come out of there could also be something that happens in other similar rural places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just hope, you know, looking forward, and a lot of us are saying, you know, when students do return fully in the building, when there's enough vaccines and everything, there's still going to be some form of, you know, online learning. I think there's going to be a lot more, you know, like blended type learning and just situations where kids will be needing to access the internet a lot more at home, right? And, you know, I just, the fact is that it's not going away, right? And this is something we needed, you know, even I think about when I taught, you know, early in the 2000s or mid 2000s. And at that time you would say, okay, well, I'm not going to assign something that requires the internet because there's a certain amount of kids that don't have it, but then that you're still talking, you know, in the 2019 or 2018 about, you know, that there were certain kids that didn't have access to the internet. But after all this, the pandemic and the remote learning is over. I mean, we can't have that excuse because we know that they got through this time, and you know, that there's going to be, you know, that we're going to have to access something. And that's why, like you're saying, having the companies reach out, having the mobile hotspots and just like, you know, somebody from the outside actually maybe partnering with districts and identifying where the need is, right? Because mm-hmm. like being in the mud pit, kind of being in the middle of the mess, and just having like in the spring, everybody going remote, all of a sudden, you know, was kind of a chaotic situation. And there were many districts that just had to make packets and drive them out to students, right? Because they hadn't pre-planned anything, right? But I think after this is all over, I sure hope that there are, you know, more resources, more partnering. Like you said, these multi-million dollar companies are able to see the just kind of what's happened with the inequities in education, and that we're, you know, able to get internet resources. I would hope by at least, you know, 2023 or 25, right? to like, you know, have that across the board for students, right?
So. Yeah. And I think like by 2025, that is definitely going to be the year where we'll see a full evolution of what education is, because at this rate, I mean, the pandemic has been going on for the better portion of a year. In a few months, it will have been a full year. Yeah. And like you're saying, like, we can't go back. Like, yeah, there is no back. There's only, how can we do more, not necessarily with more technology, but like, how can we do more in terms of equity and SEL?
Yeah.
Now and in the future, because that's going to, the humanity aspect is going to be needed more than anything else. If you've read Ready Player One, Ready Player Two just came out. I just got my copy, super excited. One of the things that, even though it's a fiction book, mm-hmm, you read it, you get goosebumps. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was written in 2011 and you're like, oh, that chapter where celebrities become presidents, like, goodness, he wrote the future. But I'm very interested to see what Ernest Cline has written in Ready Player Two, because just in reflecting on everything in Ready Player One, for example, a lot of what is described in the education world in that particular book of fiction, mm-hmm, I think is what we're going to start to see in a certain way, maybe not with the full bodysuits until about 2030, but the full-on connectedness and the just the more global interaction aspect that technology brings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it kind of makes me think of like, I worked in a new building back in 2008, and they had, you know, their connectivity and like, just, they had like an auditorium, like a small, it was like a mini auditorium, but you could bring your class in and you could do calls, mm-hmm, you know, over Skype. That was pretty much all there was in 2008 at the time, with classes in Singapore or, you know, across the world. And, you know, there were several teachers that took part in those type of, you know, just kind of virtual learning sessions with other schools throughout the world. But, you know, that's been available to schools that have connectivity, but, you know, that's something that, you know, I hope we're going to take a lot more advantage of, you know, post pandemic as well, is to, you know, integrate some of our learning with either those guest speakers that are across the world, or, you know, having those school, you know, maybe sister classes, right, that are working with us and that are having the same lesson, and they're experiencing things and telling us, you know, about a science experiment that they were doing in Australia or something like that. Because,
right,
you know, getting, you know, bringing the world closer together that way, right, will be so, so great for students. And I think, you know, a lot more teachers through the pandemic, you know, if they weren't comfortable with tech tools already, have definitely learned a lot, and you know, hopefully will not just, you know, have that fall by the wayside post pandemic, right? So
oh yeah, like everything that's being learned now, it might have to be unlearned for something new, or like the updated version of the new thing. Mm-hmm. But like all the tech things that are being now are going to be, it's like kind of evergreen, you know, like they're going to be necessary. Yeah. And they're going to have updates that come with them. But yeah, it's not like a one-time learning experience really for anybody, because even if we look at the impact that it's having on students, these tools that we're using, especially high school students, right? If we're doing a bunch of Zooms or Google Meets or using Slack or anything like that, those are all tools that they'll see in the professional world, or they'll see when they go to college.
Yeah.
So they're becoming versed on it while we're becoming versed on it. And I think that's totally fine. That's what learning is all about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, I think one thing that's been pointed out a lot, especially for those kids in middle school and high school level, are just that being, you know, appropriate behaviors and, you know, mm-hmm, kind of that, politeness, and just, you know, kind of even when your email communications, right? If everything's being a digital communication, a lot of those high school kids weren't really maybe as professional or, you know, school appropriate in the beginning of the pandemic. And I think that's mm-hmm. something that's, you know, a lot of teachers have taken some time to kind of, you know, explain some of those behaviors. And that's something that they'll take with them as well to college. You know, just kind of what's that acceptable, you know, email communication behavior and, you know, yeah, that all ties into digital citizenship as well. But kids have had that wake up call, right? As to, you know, what you can say and those type of things. So out of everything we've discussed today, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
I think it's pretty simple. You know, just breathe and remember that we're all human. And so when we interact with one another, when we interact with our students, mm-hmm. let's use a little empathy and think of what it's like when, you know, when we're really stressed out and we miss a deadline or when we don't get something right. And we need to turn that empathy on for our students more now than ever before. Because when they see us responding to them through a lens of empathy, then they're going to pass that on to the people that they interact with in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great point to end with. Where can people find you online and connect with you?
Everywhere. So I'm on Twitter at Tara Linney. My organization is TL Specialists, and it's just at tlspecialists.com. Yeah, those are my main places. I've got an Instagram. I'm not really on it that much. And LinkedIn.
Okay, great, great. I'll put those in the show notes. And I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me a little bit about your experience in the ed tech world and some of the tips and tools that you've given to other educators. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.